Good evening. This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Monday, January 11th, 2021. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ahead this hour, the Arkansas legislative session gets underway today. We'll preview various aspects of the 2021 session, including bills that have already been filed, COVID-19 precautions being implemented, and security concerns prompted by a riot at the nation's capital last week. Also, we'll learn about the life and work of Ozark folk artist Essie Ward. She's the subject of a program this weekend at the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History. We'll hear that story in the second half of today's program. Tomorrow on 1A, how much support did last week's attack on the U.S. Capitol have from law enforcement? That story and the latest on the moves to remove the president from office next time on 1A. Listen tomorrow morning from 9 to 11 here on KUAF 91.3. A record 268 Arkansans being treated for COVID-19 are on ventilators. That's an increase of 31 people in a 24-hour period. The Arkansas Department of Health also reports a record 1,371 hospitalizations, an increase of 31. Another 38 Arkansans have died from the virus, and health officials report there are 25,534 active cases across the state. In its most recent report, ADH added nearly 1,300 new cases to the state's total, which has surpassed 256,000. The counties with the most new cases are Benton with 154, Washington with 149, Pulaski with 146, Sebastian with 86, and Garland with 69. In a statement, Governor Asa Hutchinson said the report of 31 additional hospitalizations will add to the load of our healthcare workers. The better news, though, is that the new cases are starting to slow somewhat. He urged Arkansans to work together toward a true downward trend. Governor Hutchinson will deliver his weekly update on the pandemic this afternoon. You can listen live starting at 1:30 here on KUAF. The owners of more than 20 bars in Arkansas, including several in Fayetteville, have filed a lawsuit challenging the state's 11 p.m. curfew, which Governor Asa Hutchinson enacted back in November at the recommendation of the Winter COVID-19 Task Force. The original order was supposed to expire on January 3rd, but late last month, the governor extended it an additional 4 weeks to February 3rd. Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek has more from bar owners who say they feel unfairly targeted by the state.
We are under heavy restrictions already.
That's Dave Bass, the owner of Shots Big and Yeehog along Dixon Street in Fayetteville. And he's talking about the restrictions imposed on restaurants and bars back in June when the state moved into phase two of business reopenings.
Started out with phase one and a certain capacity, and then now we're at phase two. We're still there, which is actually a 66% capacity. We have to enforce mask regulations, social distancing, but we've never gotten away from 33% capacity, because by the order of the governor and the health department, if you have that many people in the building, it's impossible to be able to social distance the way they expect.
And then, on top of that, Bass says, the governor placed further restrictions on bars by imposing an 11 p.m. curfew on those establishments.
We certainly wanted to be a part of the solution and not the problem, if there was such a thing for us to do. So we did that. We took on that burden with our businesses, and we knew that with the strict restrictions involved, and we knew that with a curfew, it was just going to be untenable.
Bass says since the curfew went into effect, he's only been able to open Shots and Big for one day. And he's kept Yeehog open only because he has several full-time employees who have to earn an income.
We took the hit. We're losing money there, too. But we had to give them an opportunity to earn something.
When the governor extended the curfew another month, Bass says he and several other bar owners decided to take action by filing a lawsuit against Asa Hutchinson, Health Secretary Dr. Jose Romero, and Dora Lee Chandler, who is the director of the Alcohol Beverage Control Commission, which is charged with enforcing the state's guidelines for bars and restaurants.
We're at the very bottom of the ADH graph, the charts as far as infection rate coming out of bars, it's 0.1%. And these are their numbers, not ours. So why are they closing down the very bottom rate business and leaving everybody else open? So we certainly feel like we're being targeted, we're being singled out, vilified, if you will.
The lawsuit also includes a graph published by the health department on November 19th, showing that of the active cases of COVID-19 at the time, about 37 people said they visited a bar. Meanwhile, more than 1,800 individuals reported having been to retail stores. Almost 650 had gone to churches. About 610 visited restaurants. Some 460 went to health and wellness establishments. And around 160 went to gyms in the 2 weeks prior to a positive diagnosis. At that time, the state also reported more than 2,500 coronavirus cases at schools across the state and nearly 800 cases at colleges and universities.
You know, our business, you know, has not been shut down by the pandemic. The governor shut us down. And that's what we want to get across, that it's just unfairly legislated by a governor who's trying to make, you know, an executive order that's outside his reach.
According to the latest health department data, bars continue to be the least visited place by people who later tested positive for COVID-19. But Bass says right now, bars, private clubs, and restaurants with on-premise alcohol permits are the only industries with regulations that are being enforced with fines.
They really can't regulate, per se, retail. They can't as much regulate other business models. But with us, because we have an ABC agent, or we have an ABC license attached to us, they have that power.
During last Tuesday's weekly COVID-19 response briefing, Governor Hutchinson was asked about the reasoning behind extending the curfew if contact tracers are not finding that closing bars early is helping with the spread of the virus.
Well, I guess if you use that logic, there's not any reason to keep restaurants at two-thirds capacity if our cases are going up, so let's just let them go to full capacity. That doesn't make sense either. You know, in terms of the bars, I'd love to talk to the contact tracers. If the data, you know, that's one of the reasons that our restriction is only for 30 days. If we see that that's not necessary, I'll be the first one to be delighted to lift that.
Health Secretary Dr. Jose Romero also responded to the question. First, by saying state epidemiologists haven't found any statistical information that bars and restaurants are the sources of COVID-19 infection. The spread, he said, is mostly coming from private social gatherings. Romero then followed up with this.
The 11 p.m. curfew is a way of decreasing increased socialization. Alcohol and COVID don't mix. Right? You know, this is not something that is your ability to make correct decisions goes down in a social environment, right? So we close these bars earlier, we remove people from these environments and try to decrease it in those settings.
But Dave Bass takes issue with that assumption. He says just because bars shut down doesn't necessarily mean people stop drinking and socializing.
People are going to do what they're going to do. They're going to go to a house party. They're going to go to a residence, and they're going to pile in with anywhere from 30 to 100 people, no mask, no social distancing, no restrictions to abide by. And that's where this spread is really happening.
When people are at the bar, at least there are sober employees there to keep track of whether everyone is social distancing and wearing masks.
We've actually added security to our clubs. We've added one person for mask duty and we've added one person for social distancing. So we're constantly going around and reminding people of your mask, and when they don't have a drink in their hand and trying to get them to understand. It's tough. It's not a foolproof job. You're going to have people that'll take their mask down prematurely and you've got to get to them.
Hannah Withers is the co-owner and operator of Maxine's Tap Room in Fayetteville. She's also one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit against the state. Like Bass, Withers has made additional investments in staff at her establishment to make sure all patrons are following the guidelines.
Our labor costs have gone up dramatically. And most bars and restaurants right now, if they're lucky, are hitting 50% of what their sales used to be pre-COVID.
Withers says she joined the lawsuit because the bar industry has had no representation on the task force that's making economic and health decisions for the state. And while she understood the original intention of the curfew during the holidays, when people are more likely to gather, the extension, Withers adds, feels performative.
I think the state saying that they are giving us curfews and taking away our operating hours makes them feel like they're doing something.
Like the bars owned by Bass, Maxine's is also operating at a third of its capacity because social distancing guidelines will not allow for a 66% occupancy rate. Withers says the curfew is cutting even further into their business.
When you open at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and you close at 2 a.m. and you take 3 hours off the end of you being able to open, they're taking away 30% of our operating hours. And I see a language online when people are talking about this issue, and they're talking about how unessential, how non-essential our businesses are and how we shouldn't be open at all. But our other option is to file for bankruptcy and not make our mortgage and rent payments and not be able to feed our kids.
Withers says she doesn't usually respond to state rules and regulations by filing a lawsuit, but she also felt like she had no other choice.
This is not a partisan issue for me, and this is not certainly something. This is certainly not something that I do with joy, or that I'm looking forward to doing.
She hopes the lawsuit will lead to an injunction of the curfew, while the litigation makes its way through the legal system.
So I'd like to see an injunction that would give us 6 or 8 weeks, maybe depending on how long it takes to get to court, to give us some time to recoup a little bit of our profit that we've lost. I'm not sure that anybody in our industry is really making a profit at anything, but at least allow us to continue to limp by until we can get something back to some semblance of normal.
And Withers adds she wants the industry to be heard and acknowledged for its contributions to communities across Arkansas.
I think that what bars and restaurants do in our communities is that we serve as cornerstones and we serve as these community places that create the culture and the personalities of what our towns feel like. And I think that there are a lot of us that are not going to make it through the next couple months. And I'm not sure that anybody's hearing us when we say that.
Withers and her husband are also planning to once again file for unemployment because they're not making any income from their businesses as they try to keep them afloat. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzana Sitek.
According to last month's jobs report, the recent increase in coronavirus cases was responsible for the loss of nearly 500,000 leisure and hospitality jobs, with more than 370,000 of those in restaurants and bars. A report from the National Restaurant Association released in December also found more than 110,000 establishments have closed permanently or long term. The majority of those were well-established restaurants that, on average, had been in business for 16 years.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Last November, a number of Arkansas Republican state lawmakers voiced opposition to proposed rules requiring the wearing of masks at the state capitol during the 2021 legislative session. A compromise was reached to protect lawmakers during the pandemic, just days before the Arkansas General Assembly was scheduled to open for business at noon today. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich spoke with incoming Senate President Pro Tem Jimmy Hickey about the new COVID rules, and she has this report.
With more federal and state legislators sickened with COVID-19, many states are adopting procedures to protect lawmakers during in-person sessions. In late November, a proposed rule requiring a majority Republican Arkansas legislature to wear masks during the 93rd General Assembly was not well received. But Arkansas incoming Senate President Pro Tem Jimmy Hickey, a Republican from Texarkana, in an interview on Friday, says masks are being worn today, the first day of the session, and other COVID procedures followed.
We've literally been working on this for about 4 months.
Hickey has been working with Speaker of the House Matthew Shepard, a Republican from El Dorado, the Arkansas Legislative Bureau, Senate and House staff, and certain committee chairs, he says.
You know, everybody's going to be required to wear a mask. Of course, they can take it off if they're going to be speaking in a microphone and they're socially distanced, you know. Of course, if they want to take a drink, we're going to allow them to take it off for that. So, yes, that is in the procedures.
The Arkansas Senate, comprised of 35 members, and Arkansas House of Representatives with 100 members, staff, lobbyists, and the public will all be required to wear masks and maintain social distance. The Arkansas Secretary of State has assisted in setting up screening processes at all entrances.
Of course, everybody that comes into the Capitol is going to have a temperature, their temperature checked, health screening. And then what we're calling this is like a restricted business session. So in other words, if you have business at the Capitol, if you're there to see a constitutional officer, if you have something with the Secretary of State, of course, you can go in and do your business.
Inside the 247,000 square foot Capitol in Little Rock, legislators who meet in House and Senate chambers, as well as morning committee meetings, will be spaced out and split up to accommodate the 6-foot rule.
Our committee rooms are going to be different this year than what they've always been. The Senate is going to utilize the rooms over in the Capitol because they're a little bit smaller. Of course, we're smaller. And then the House is going to utilize committee rooms over in a larger building that we refer to as Big Mac B, where we have a bunch of our joint meetings so that they can more easily social distance over there.
And Arkansas constituents can view all bills filed online at ark.leg.state.ar.us.
Those bills can be run at any point in time. This year, what we're going to do, those bills will be put on that list, which we call the referred list. However, they will not go onto an active agenda until the sponsor or the presenter of that bill has contacted the chair, and then they will go on that active agenda. The quickest that bill will be presented is in 18 hours, and that is a minimal. That way, what that does is allow the public, the media, and everybody else to know that there is a scheduled time for that bill to be heard. If that member does not show up to do that, then what will transpire is that'll roll all the way back to the referred list, and they would have to go through that process again.
Participation by constituents, lobbyists, and the curious will be limited due to safe spacing, with room allocated for administrative and agency officials.
There's limited seating in the committee room. But we do have seating in there for that. But what we've also done is taking additional rooms which are close to the committee rooms, and we have set up some large TV screens in there, and we have direct feed that goes from the committee room into those we're calling them holding rooms or bullpen rooms, whatever you want to call them, so that people that are going to testify on bills, they will be in that room. They'll be able to see what's going on. We've got additional staff that will bring them directly out of the holding room into the committee room so they're able to testify in person at the end of the table as always.
Traditional hallway congregating on the third and fourth floor have been replaced by socially distant chairs, as well as in-person visits with legislators curtailed.
That way, if somebody's there that wants to be part of the process but is not going to be testifying, they will have a spot that they can go to, and if they want to talk to their legislator or go to their office, they can text them or call them and do it that way.
Session chamber and committee meetings will be live streamed every day, and legislators who are in isolation or quarantine can participate remotely once their identities are legally confirmed. The Arkansas Department of Health has combed through the Capitol to make sure everything is in COVID order, Hickey says.
We had them to actually come into the chambers. And as far as like our galleries, we know what the seating is in our galleries. If anybody that's been there knows that we have a gallery on each side. Each side will hold, according to the health department, only nine people there. We have allowed for like press, you know that. That old saying that we're being transparent, we're really trying to do that.
Media will also be given additional access to live streaming monitoring rooms. The General Assembly session COVID procedures are temporary and in effect during the state's public health emergency declared March 11th last year by Governor Asa Hutchinson, now extended through the end of next month. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
With COVID-19 protocols now in place, Arkansas legislators can focus their attention on the laws they will try to pass during the 2021 session. To find out what we can expect during the Arkansas legislative session, Sarah Kellogg from our partner station KUAR in Little Rock spoke with Andrew DeMillo, Capitol correspondent for the Little Rock Bureau of the Associated Press.
Clearly, tax cuts, again, are going to be a big point of discussion and debate in the session. The governor has laid out his budget proposal for the coming year that includes $50 million in tax cuts, including a break for new residents. Another issue is hate crimes legislation. The governor has made hate crimes legislation, which would be enhanced sentences for crimes that are committed against someone because of one of multiple factors: race, religion, sexual orientation. He has made this a big part of his agenda, and based on past years, this will likely, this is going to be a tough bill to get through, and one that we're going to see a lot of pushback over. So I'd imagine that would take up a good amount of session. Redistricting is going to be another big issue with the most recent census, and this is a congressional redistricting. It's also clear that abortion, which just about every session has been a big issue here, is going to be even more so given the conservative shift on the U.S. Supreme Court or shift further to the right to the U.S. Supreme Court. We've already seen one bill filed that would effectively ban nearly all abortions in the state. Given past years, what we've seen, I don't think that's going to be the only one that comes up. The big unknown about the session is healthcare. The Medicaid expansion that Arkansas has been a regular fight nearly every year since it was approved here, but it has always managed to get reauthorized, sometimes very narrowly. But this time we've got the bigger issue of what is the U.S. Supreme Court going to do with the Affordable Care Act? There's still a case pending with them over that challenge to that law. And what happens if SCOTUS strikes it down? Where does that leave Arkansas? And where does that leave the thousands who are receiving coverage? And also, where does that leave Arkansas's budget? Depending on the timing of that and what happens with that ruling, that could be a decision that could really kind of upend the things in the session as well.
And this is kind of in a similar vein, but what are some bills that you've already noted or seen? What are some bills to look out for?
Hate crimes legislation, that was one of the first bills that was filed during pre-filing. And that's going to be one of the top ones to look for. We've seen the abortion restriction that I mentioned that had been filed, as well as we've seen a proposal for tax relief or for low and middle income Arkansans that would be paid for with an increase in tobacco taxes. And this is similar to legislation that passed a couple of years ago in the Senate but stalled in the House. And then we've kind of seen a hodgepodge of other bills that have been filed so far, even ones dealing with desecration of the U.S. flag and monuments at the Capitol, proposal dealing with creating a law enforcement integrity unit with state police. And I think we're going to see more of that, but we're at least getting a sense from kind of the first bills that are filed, what the big issues are going to be just based on that pre-filing.
What will the session look like kind of on a logistical basis? How will COVID-19 kind of change, one, how the session goes, but also kind of the focus of the session?
Logistically, I think you're already seeing some of this. We've seen plexiglass that's been set up in the chambers and in some of the committee rooms. I think we'll likely see, an effort to try to keep the session shorter and try to keep some meetings shorter so there's less of an interaction. I think we've already seen kind of why there's the concern over that. Arkansas has had one of the biggest outbreaks in the state legislature of COVID, and most of those cases occurred after the start of budget hearings, which is more limited number of lawmakers. What happens when you bring 135 lawmakers into a limited space like the Capitol? The House is not going to be meeting in the basketball arena like they have in previous years. So I think they're going to have to kind of figure out the challenge of doing that. Policy-wise, I think it will be interesting to watch is we've seen, Governor Hutchinson has, he's faced some resistance from members of his own party over the state's restrictions, over the mask mandate. You know, even had a group of Republican lawmakers who sued, trying to overturn these restrictions. The issue to watch is, does this turn into a legislative push? Is there going to be some effort to have more of a legislative say in these restrictions, either during this pandemic or in the future? And that's going to be one of the things to watch. And also, are there going to be other lessons learned from the way the state handled the pandemic that are going to turn into changes in the way the state responds to emergencies in the future? So, yeah, I think we may see that. And it really depends on where things are at during the session in terms of the cases, in terms of what's happening with vaccinations. So it could have a policy impact.
And with state Republicans emerging with a supermajority in both chambers after the election, do you think there's going to be still like a lot of cooperation?
I think in certain areas you'll see it. Yeah, I think the hate crimes legislation is one example where we've seen kind of an interesting coalition of Republicans and Democratic legislators on this. And I think you'll see some working together on that. You know, earned income tax credit may be another area. And that's going to be kind of the challenge for Democrats is really, trying to find a way to have a say, despite being the minority party right now.
That was Andrew DeMillo of the Associated Press speaking with Sarah Kellogg from our partner station KUAR in Little Rock. Although the session didn't officially start until today, legislators began filing bills and resolutions November 16th. February 10th, for example, is the deadline to file constitutional amendments. January 25th is the deadline to file retirement legislation and certain health care legislation, while March 1st is the deadline to file appropriation bills. However, both of these dates may be extended.
As COVID vaccines become more available, some people are hesitant. But what if the vaccine came with money?
We just have a lot of people in this country who either don't trust the government or they don't trust vaccines or whatever. I view the payment for a vaccine as the price we pay for having a divided country.
Why some economists and politicians think it's necessary on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, tomorrow morning from 5 to 9 on KUAF 91.3. On Friday, two top Arkansas lawmakers and Governor Asa Hutchinson fielded questions from reporters at a two-hour virtual roundtable. The press conference was hosted by the Arkansas Press Association and Associated Press. Questions regarded bills under consideration by the 93rd General Assembly, pandemic issues and procedures, as well as the recent attack by Trump supporters on the U.S. Capitol last week. Ozarks at-large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
Along with incoming Senate President Jimmy Hickey, a Republican from Texarkana, House Speaker Matthew Shepard, a Republican from El Dorado, opened the virtual press conference, welcoming over a dozen reporters.
I appreciate the work that the Press Association and its members and the working press across the state and across our country do each and every day.
Shepard says constraining COVID-19 safeguards are in place in the state capitol to protect lawmakers, staff, lobbyists, and the public. So the press is required even more than ever to provide transparency into this year's session. Senator Hickey took the first question regarding the pandemic emergency declaration issued by Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson last March, now extended through late February. A group of conservative lawmakers are seeking to scale back the emergency powers held by the governor and State Board of Health and lift COVID restrictions.
I believe on the Senate side, and of course that's all that I'll be talking about, it'll be on the Senate side. I believe that the support is there to work with the governor.
Hickey and Shepard say the legislative branch needs to have strict oversight of any declarations and restrictions during an emergency or catastrophe, which will require amending the Arkansas Emergency Powers Act. Increasing teacher pay to attract more teachers to the state and expanding broadband, as well as an inclusive hate crimes bill, were some of the first items also discussed.
You know, sometimes there are issues that you can resolve in advance of session and kind of have an idea of where you're headed as you move into session. I think because of the challenges of COVID and the fact that we've not had some of the interaction that we normally would have had prior to a session, that just creates an environment where we more or less have to get here and start having those discussions. I'm open to that discussion, but I want to hear, you know, all the different viewpoints, particularly from my membership on the House end. And then, you know, we'll see if we're able to develop consensus on that.
The two lawmakers were queried about beefing up security at the state capitol after pro-Trump extremists stormed the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. January 6th. Hickey responded first.
You know, here in Arkansas, we're all just citizen legislators, and these constituents, they know they can talk to us. And I'm hoping that from that standpoint, we don't have any type of trouble.
Shepard responded to a reporter's query about a controversial Stand Your Ground bill that will be reintroduced this session, which, if passed, would allow the use of deadly force to protect self and property. Nearly 35 states have enacted such laws. In the second hour of the virtual press conference, Governor Asa Hutchinson also expressed gratitude to Arkansas journalists.
I want to thank all of those that are participating in this, but also what you contribute in sometimes courageous fashions to our public knowledge and information and the scrutiny that you bring.
Hutchinson says he expects a safe assembly this year despite a worsening pandemic. Daily open-door meetings with legislators and in-person ceremonial bill signings will be limited this year, but Hutchinson believes much will be accomplished.
I expect that we're going to have income tax cuts. We're going to invest $100 million in our reserve fund that we'll be able to talk about the expansion of rural broadband, that we will raise teachers' pay during this session, and we'll accomplish sentencing reform, law enforcement reform, and pass hate crimes legislation.
Hutchinson was also queried about a bill to ban abortions in Arkansas, which he supports. He also expects lawmakers to debate pandemic funding and vaccination throughput.
I believe that during times of urgency and during times of challenge, we come together as a state and a nation. And we are certainly in a time of challenge here in the state of Arkansas from the pandemic that we see here in our state and across the country to the pandemonium and panic that we have seen over the last week in Washington, D.C.
Referring to the December 6th pro-Trump insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, Hutchinson says Trump used, quote, bad judgment.
And the result of it is the riots in the nation's capital, destruction of property and loss of life, and a black mark on our democracy.
The governor says it's time to proceed through the transition and inauguration, saying impeaching Trump is not a solution. Hutchinson, a longtime Trump supporter, believes the outgoing president will not resign. He would not comment on possible criminal charges, but did say Trump's presidency is over.
Yes, I want this administration to end. That was chaotic. It was he misled his supporters. It hurt us.
With the Arkansas legislature now in session and reports of extremists organizing to violently protest across the country leading up to the inauguration and beyond, Hutchinson, who served as the first undersecretary of the Department of Homeland Security, says measures are being taken to protect the public and property in Arkansas, including the state capitol.
Obviously, with what we saw in our nation's capital, the security will be heightened in terms of, one, trying to gather any intelligence about any threats, but also mindful that the public will be concerned and that we do not want to have any semblance of violence or riots here in Arkansas. I don't expect it, but we will be prepared for that in the event that becomes something to be more concerned with.
A link to the Arkansas General Assembly's daily calendar, bills, agendas, and videos can be found on OzarksAtLarge.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The clean sweep of all the levers of power in Washington by Democrats has cleared the way for a more progressive legislative program. A carbon fee and dividend program is one of the ideas favored by the liberal Citizens Climate Lobby. Northwest Arkansas manufacturer Patrick Kinneman has been a member of that group for several years, and he was a guest on this weekend's edition of Talk Business and Politics. Kinneman is working to promote the idea, which he says is different than cap and trade.
essentially places a fee on carbon. It's predictable and steadily rising over time, and it's placed on carbon at the source of extraction or point of entry, so be it in other greenhouse gases as well, so be it at a mine, well, or at a port of entry. Now, that fee is then carried, obviously, through the market and ends with the end consumer in terms of increased energy expense, which creates an incentive for the market to more rapidly move towards renewable energy sources.
Kinnaman says we are already making the transition towards a renewable energy future.
The question is, how quickly can we get there in order to mitigate as much of the climate impact as we possibly can? And by adding this fee, which is truly really assessing the actual cost of that carbon-intensive fuel source, we are able to help the market more rapidly move towards those other energy sources, such as wind, solar, or for Arkansas, geothermal.
The government would provide a monthly dividend to every U.S. citizen to offset their much higher energy prices. But he claims since it's a market-based mechanism, the amount of bureaucratic involvement would be minimal and the administrative expense much less than with cap and trade.
Does Neptune have rings? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto manager with NASA Goddard, and this is Scratching the Surface. Neptune does indeed have rings, but certainly not as spectacular as Saturn and Uranus. Instead, the rings of Neptune are very faint and dusty. There are five main rings, first discovered in 1984 at the La Silla Observatory in Chile, then eventually imaged by the Voyager 2 spacecraft in 1989. Neptune's rings are named after the astronomers who contributed to the studies of Neptune. These are Galilei, Le Verrier, LaSalle, Arago, and Adams. The rings of Neptune are very dark, likely irradiated methane that has been compounded into hydrocarbons. This similar process is also found in the rings of Uranus. Also, these rings have gaps in between, and what resides in these gaps are moons, called shepherd moons, where shepherd moons essentially gravitationally control the dust and ice rings into circular orbits around Neptune. Such ring systems and their interactions with tiny moons still provides plenty of questions about Neptune and the ring systems, such as, how did the rings originate? Why are Uranus and Neptune's rings darker compared to Jupiter and Saturn? And do the ice from the shepherd moons interact with the rings, or vice versa? For more segments of Scratching the Surface, visit KUAF.com.
The KUAF Pluto manager, Caitlin Ahrens, studied space and planetary sciences at the University of Arkansas. She's currently a postdoctoral researcher at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. Scratching the Surface is a production of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville, Arkansas.
The Shiloh Museum of Ozark History is hosting its monthly Shiloh Saturday Series event this weekend. January's virtual program, which will be presented on the museum's Facebook page, is called Paint Like Essie Ward. Families can tune in to watch education specialist and weekend manager Kimberly Hosey in a pre-recorded program as she paints her own scene from the Ozarks and discusses the life and work of the Ozark folk artist. Participants are encouraged to follow along or paint their own scene. Late Friday afternoon, I spoke with Kimberly Hosey to learn more about the Ozark artist who inspired this week's program.
So Essie Ward, she's kind of hard to fit into one box. She was a mother, a wife, a farmer, a folk artist in the Arkansas Ozarks. So she worked her entire life to raise a family, working on her farm, and then also eventually later in life made a living painting folk art. People purchased her art from all around the country, in different countries even. She painted and was artistic her entire life. It wasn't just later in life, but she was eventually diagnosed with cancer. And so she slowed down a little bit towards around, I want to say, the 1950s, not as active on the farm anymore, and, you know, began picking up a paintbrush and painting, and that became her main, what she did, her main activity, more commonly.
And so was she
well known just within Arkansas, or did she have a following outside of the state?
She had a following outside the state as well. She definitely brought a lot of attention to the Arkansas Ozarks. A lot of people in the state and this region, commissioned paintings from her. And she even in 1970, I want to say, participated in the Smithsonian's Festival of American Folklife. So that was in Washington, D.C. And I also read and have heard stories about how people in different countries even gained access to her art and her paintings. So she definitely was well known other places besides just Arkansas.
And I was reading in the Encyclopedia of Arkansas that she was called by some the Grandma Moses.
Yes, of the Ozarks.
Of the
yes.
Ozarks. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So she, I've done a little bit of background research on Grandma Moses. And so, so Essie, again, later in life, became very successful as a folk artist, similar to Grandma Moses. And so I think that's related to how she gets the term Grandma Moses of the Ozarks. And so again, she really started making a living with these paintings. She really started getting more active in her commissioned paintings around later in her life.
And so as a painter, what are some of the art pieces that she created? Is she known for a particular subject matter for each painting, or what is very much her style?
So she, the paintings, she's painted a variety of paintings, ranging from landscapes and natural scenes of the Ozarks. She painted from a lot of representation of her daily life. So maybe paintings of life on the farm, or the two main subjects that you see in a variety of her paintings are Hezekiah and Miranda. They are she created these two characters who were similar to, herself or family members or people that she had interacted with her whole life. And they were the characters represented an older Ozark pioneer couple. And so they would get themselves into all sorts of situations on their farmstead, and she would paint out those scenes. And that's a really common subject that she would paint. So Hezekiah and Miranda, you'll see a variety of landscapes. For example, life near the Buffalo River, bluffs, Native American subjects. She had a passion for that as well. So you see a variety of different subjects.
And what do we mean when we say folk art? Because I've heard it used in a number of different ways over the years, but in this particular instance, what are we referring to?
And a definition I like to consider folk art is just art that's specific to a certain region or area and that culture and the heritage in that area. So when we say folk artist or Arkansas Ozarks folk painting or folk artist, I think, just a representation of the culture of this region of Arkansas.
How did you come to choose her as the subject for your upcoming event?
So for our Shiloh Saturday programs, we host one a month. And for the Paint Like Essie program, that's the Shiloh Saturday program for January. We like to choose topics that relate to the history and culture of the Arkansas Ozarks. And this just happened to relate to the fact that we are about to re-implement an Essie Ward temporary exhibit at the museum, and that opens in February. And so we kind of wanted to get people excited for the exhibit. And also, we always love telling the story of Essie Ward. I mean, she's so inspirational and just very one of a kind. And we wanted something that, with our virtual programs, we try to get the viewers to be as hands-on as we can. So we figured with the mixture of the Essie Ward exhibit coming up and, just the fact that Essie is such a fantastic subject to learn about and teach about, we thought this would be a really fun way to start off the year.
And how did the Shiloh Museum come to have her work in their collection?
Yeah, the Essie Ward collections at the museum goes back decades. Someone who had purchased a huge collection, had commissioned a huge collection of Hezekiah and Miranda paintings, I want to say around 40, was moving out of the state. And she wanted some place to keep this collection, and she wanted it to be in Arkansas to keep the collection of S.E. Ward paintings, you know, near home and someplace that would take care of it and also be able to tell the story of S.E. Ward. And so the museum board held a fundraiser and we were able to gain that collection at the museum. And ever since then, we've added to the collection a little bit here and there. So I think at this point in time, we have about 55 S.E. Ward paintings in our collection. So we've been collecting them for years and years and years, and it just keeps growing.
So for Saturday's event, Paint Like S.E. Ward, you are going to be painting like S.E. Ward, correct?
Yes, I'm going to be doing my best. So I really do like to paint, but I am definitely not an artist. I've never been, especially never been trained as an artist. So I really just like to dabble in creative things, and especially if there's something I haven't done before. So always trying to get my hands into something new. And we were brainstorming an idea for the program, and I was like, well, you know, we could do like a follow along program where I can paint and people can follow along with what I'm doing. Or, you know, maybe they'll be inspired by Essie's story and they'll get bit by the creative bug, and then maybe paint something that they find inspiring or that they think is beautiful. So, with the painting that we do for the program, it's not necessarily based off of one particular S.E. Ward painting. It is just using her many similar styles, many similar materials and subject matter. So we're going to be painting a scene, like a natural scene, a landscape scene of the Ozarks.
Well, what are some of the materials that she's known for using?
She painted on Masonite board. So she didn't use canvas. She didn't use wood, at least more commonly used Masonite. She said that wood ended up warping and just liked working on Masonite better. She used oil paint. She didn't use a palette to put the paint on. She just took a paintbrush and stuck it straight into the tube of paint, and that's how she painted. She didn't use an easel or anything like that. She just held the Masonite board in her lap or used a furniture arm to support it as she was painting. And she had her own little routine, and honestly, it worked really well for her. All of her paintings are beautiful. Something that you can notice in every single one of her paintings is her trademark, which are two white marks that resemble rabbit ears or mule ears, but they're not necessarily ears. They just look like them. And so we always like to point out the paintings to, you know, school children who come through the museum or just people who are viewing exhibits or programs with S.E. Ward, like, see if you can spot her trademark that's in every single one of her paintings. So we're going to be incorporating that into the program as well.
And so people can choose to paint along or just watch whatever they choose or feel like with their families. And they can watch all of this on your Facebook page?
Yes. So it's a pre-recorded program. It's not live because there's going to be a little bit of traveling involved. But it's pre-recorded and it's going to be posted at 10:30 a.m. on the dot on the museum's Facebook page. And then after that, you can watch it at any time from the Facebook page.
What's it been like for you having to develop more of these virtual programs amidst the pandemic?
Honestly, you know, it's definitely a change in pace. You know, every site, every school, everyone during the pandemic has definitely had to adapt and evolve the way that they do things. So we honestly have had a lot of great experiences. We've gained a lot of video editing skills, which I did not have before. And we've actually been able to reach a wider variety of audiences because of virtual accessibility. So there are some definite perks to having virtual programs. But we also, you know, we love having people at the museum and those in-person programs as well. So there's perks to both ways of doing the programs.
And are you still having in-person programs, or are people allowed to come into the museum on a limited basis? What's that looking like?
Yeah, so the museum is currently open to the public. We're open Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 5 a.m. We're not open on the weekends. We previously were, but, you know, we have a different schedule for the time being. And we don't do in-person school programs or field trips or anything like that. And then we have our COVID guidelines, which are listed on our website and our social media outlets, which give a little bit more explanation of, you know, the amount of people in and all that stuff and our guidelines. But yeah, we're looking forward to the time where we have large groups and field trips back into the museum. But for now, we're just happy to have our guests in, even a little bit at a time.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. And best of luck.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you so much for being interested in the program.
That was Kimberly Hosey, education specialist and weekend manager at the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History. The next installment of the museum's monthly Shiloh Saturday series is this weekend. Families can watch the program on the museum's Facebook page beginning at 10:30 Saturday morning. More information is available at facebook.com/Shiloh Museum.
It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF. I'm Pete Hartman. Today, over the phone in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio, join with Jake Gibbs. He's principal of Hope Academy, located in Bentonville. Jake, nice talking to you.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Thanks for having me. Hope Academy is an open enrollment charter school, and the purpose is to serve kids who have experienced some significant childhood trauma. And as a result of that trauma, they may have behaviors that manifest in a way that don't necessarily allow them to be successful in a kind of a traditional public school setting. So we've created a space for them to come in, work through those social, emotional issues, you know, have some success both socially, emotionally, as well as academically. Well, we really started talking about it probably close to 2 years ago here at the Northwest Arkansas Children's Shelter, which is the sponsoring entity for the charter school. So it's been a couple of years in the making, and we actually have a semester under our belt. We started in August, and so this last fall semester was our opening semester. So, you know, yes, it's been a process largely because there aren't a lot of schools like this really in the nation, certainly in our state. And so the leadership team for the school and the staff have really, you know, we started out with a very focused plan, but of course, as you go along, you learn things and you have to make adjustments along the way. And that's been a big part of the process, is just coming together, learning to, you know, trusting each other, communicating, in order to make this a success.
Jake Gibbs, principal with Hope Academy, located in Bentonville. Okay, open enrollment for the 2021-2022 school year begins today, January 11th. It runs through February 12th.
If we have families who are interested in our school, who have kids that are struggling in school because of a significant trauma they've had, they can go to hopeacademynwa.org, and there they will find a place where they can apply online, and we'll get those applications during that about month period. Towards the end of February, we will announce a date where we will hold our lottery. All of our classes are full, and we do have waiting lists in a couple of classes. The only fully open room will be kindergarten.
Again, that's hopeacademynwa.org. Speaking with Jake Gibbs, principal of Hope Academy, located in Bentonville. Jake, thanks so much, and I hope it's a successful school year.
Hey, I appreciate the time. Thank you.
The Community Spotlight on KUAF Public Radio. Local matters.
This is 91.3 FM in Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Huntsville, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas. Contributors today included Susanna Sitek, Jacqueline Froelich, and Pete Hartman, as well as our partner station KUAR in Little Rock. Timothy Dennis mixed and mastered today's show. Our theme song is written and performed by Daryl Sean. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. I hope your week is off to a great start.